Hello, Agnes.
Hey, Robin.
Welcome, Jameson.
Thank you.
I was particularly taken by your essay, which so I recommended to Agnes that we bring you on. And it's mainly just because of the one point that I saw you make over and over again that I thought was an important point to pursue. And I just thought it'd be fun to pursue it with you, which is, as I read it, this idea that it's hard to get your desires in view. There's work to be done there, and it's easy to block that view if you're focused too much on what you should do, what people would approve of you doing, what your plans say you should do, what your rules say you should do. If you pay too much attention to those things, then it'll be hard to get what you want in view. And that seems true to me, and it seems important to me. And you seem to like just repeatedly emphasize that, yeah, that's a real thing and it's important. And my main question to start with, Agnes will have many more, is just, well, surely these rules and conformity is also important. Surely we need to get that in view too. We can't just entirely ignore that. So when in the process should we figure out whether our desires are, illicit? And squash them or repress them. Should we ever repress or squash or push aside or try to reshape our desires? And when should we ask that question then? Like, if not initially, at some point. I mean, there does seem like this risk that if you see a desire and you give into it and you revel in it, and then you think later, I don't know, a month later about is it any good, it might be too late maybe to back away from it. It might be sort of immersed in it. Anyway, that's my main question.
It's a good question. I mean, there's something funny about the New York Times piece, which it had this like clickbaity title. I mean, you guys know it. You can't title your own pieces.
Right.
So that set all these people off as if, I mean, and I don't know who it's, some people, they like it, and other people, it freaks them out. But I was interested in what was upsetting to people as if, there's this idea that I was advocating sort of Lord of the Flies, and just everybody go wild and indulge themselves. But, it sort of missed the character of, on the one hand, this is really hard work, which you're emphasizing that it's hard to get these desires in view. And part of the work around it, I think, is going to make you question it an awful lot if you're doing that work. Of which the question, indulge, don't indulge, do it, don't do it, is it good or is it bad? Or how can I know? Or can I know before I do it? Do I have to know before I do it? I mean, all of these ways in which we wrestle with that isn't just, some careening out of control and selfishly satisfying yourself against, causing pain to other people or something. So there's something important. I mean, one saying that something about the difficulty of desire and getting it into perspective implies a certain amount of work and a certain sacrifice too. I mean, I think I said it was hard won over and over again. But then there's this larger question for me that was important, which I didn't get into because it wasn't kind of the nature of what the Times was asking me to do, but was there in the piece, which is, we have like a society that's trying to figure out its relationship to rules, it seems like at the moment. And that's a very different question for me. That's a collective question, that's a social question. That's a question of laws and equity and justice and an ongoing project of civilization. The relationship of a person's individual desires to the collective structures under which we agree as citizens to live under. I think it's interesting to try to put those two things in different categories, actually. And part of the thing was I was saying that we're pretty mixed up right now about how to hold anybody responsible or laws, that there's something where it's coming down to us being quite punitive to people on an individual level. Whereas we can't ask, it seems very hard to ask the questions on a broader scale. Like, how do we hold people accountable? What kind of laws do we want to live under? How do we as an American people think of the pursuit of freedom? Especially freedom that would be equally distributed amongst all of the members of whatever this country. So I wanted to play around with that and think about this self rule versus collective governance confusion?
I'm a social scientist. I'm an economist. So those topics are in my bailiwick. That is, that's what we do all the time, is thinking about rules and how we form them and how we make the trade-offs for more or less rules. But I mean, just a robust observation is we've always had rules. They've changed. And I don't know that we necessarily have more rules now than we used to. We have different rules. But still, it seems like whatever the rules are, we're going to face this challenge. How much do we let ourselves see our desire without letting the rules application come in quickly? And is that just something that in therapy is the issue as you're highlighting it, that in therapy you especially need to hold off the evaluation to let yourself see the desire? Is this true for everybody, even out of therapy? Are you suggesting that we're just in general imposing our rules in too quickly before we let ourselves explore things? And that's just as a general mistake most everyone's making all the time? Or is it a mistake particular to therapy, or is it a mistake at all?
You know, I always start from what feels different. I mean, I haven't been, you know, I would also want to ask the person who's been practicing for 40 years, but practicing for 20 years, something feels very, very different at this moment, which I haven't heard so many rules from patients. I mean, you certainly hear them. There have always been rules. There are always rules. There are always parental expectations that one grows up with, this, you know, whatever, opinions.
Right.
So on and so forth. I have never heard it so much as I'm hearing it now. So I think I started with that observation and how difficult it is to cut through it with the intensity with which I'm hearing it. And to ask where this is coming from, and hearing from students, I mean, hearing from patients as well, but hearing from students and hearing from friends, but also knowing it myself, that a lot of the time, if you spend any time on social media at this point, it's filled with people telling you what to do, which is wild to me. And then wondering, how did we get into this? And, you know, there's something also about therapy, psychology, the growth of this industry, which I feel a little bit at odds with. I don't mix psychoanalysis with, I think, what has become the therapeutic world at this point. I think psychoanalysis is a bit arcane and weird and off to the side and its own strange monster. But the whole therapy speak, because patients come and they don't know the difference between an orange and an apple, and that's not their problem. It's my problem. But they think that I think this way. They think that I think like all of the TikTok memes about narcissists or whatever it is. And so I'm also like trying to listen to this and listen to what interests them, like why, you know, what's the anxiety that they want this information with all of these rules. And so I was trying to start from there. And then, you know, I don't know how, I always have a hard time leaping out from beyond this weird, the position of the analyst, you know, to what's going on more generally. But I did want to start there.
There's a paragraph in your essay in the New York Times about where you're talking about this, where you say like that there used to be like this fragmentation of all these different communities and each had their own set of rules, and somehow now we have access to all of it. And so that could be part of it, is that we're hearing the rules from a lot of different places, and then where there's also this pressure to coordinate across all these different groups. So that would be one simple explanation of, there are more rules because more people are trying to coordinate with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of my colleagues, I think, plausibly say that we're in a religious revival period, in essence. If you compare it to sort of periods in American history where there were lots of religious revivals, it's that sort of a period, a lot of energy, enthusiasm toward new expectation of new moral stances and behavior. And that's exciting, but it does focus people's attention on what are our moral stances toward things and how are they different than they were before. That would go along with a religious revival.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's right.
Have you seen the Barbie movie?
I haven't seen it yet, but I read like 300.
Okay, like I saw it. Then I won't ask you this question, but yeah.
Okay.
The speech in the movie, anyway, you'll be interested. I'll be interested one day to hear what you think of this speech. I'm sure Robin has a follow up, so I'll let you follow up, Robin.
Well, so we have these two directions in the conversation we can go. I don't want to lose. I want to pursue both, but there's the first issue of just the general problem of managing desires versus sort of rules and norms, and then there's the more specific question of what's changed lately and how should we respond to that. I guess my first inclination is to go with the more general question of just, okay, maybe things have changed lately, but we've always had this issue of it's hard to see what you want when you too quickly impose what you. So for example, I guess to take, I'm a professor, but many students don't think very much about, do they really want to go to school? They just assume they want to go to school because their parents have told them, a society tells them. And then, they're not reflecting on, do I really like school? Is that, what are the other options? And, you might tell them you should think about that more, but this is true for many things in our world, that is, people just inherit these expectations and they do it and they don't explore what they might really want instead. But other than just pointing that out, what is there to do exactly about this trade-off? That is there a way to talk about, like, just giving a desire a space, or what kind of a space to give a desire to feel it before you ask if they're good desires, if your desires you want to embrace or repress?
I mean, look, I'm such a classical Freudian. I mean, I really am. And that just basically means that we don't, you don't know yourself. You're very confused about yourself for a long time. And for the rest of your life, even if you do psychoanalysis, you will inevitably come up with some conceit about yourself that will have to get challenged and undone, hopefully. Or you could live misrecognizing yourself to the very end. It's also a possibility, and plenty of people do, and that's a life. So who gets shaken and needs to be picked up is, one place that I think I step in, because something happened, right? And then the person gets thrown and they might have a crisis or a breakdown or a really extreme emotional reaction or a depression or get flooded with anxiety. And then they end up hopefully on a good person's doorstep. She says, let's put together the picture of what unraveled everything for you. Or you might be someone in an existential dilemma. Doesn't feel particularly quote unquote psychiatric, but you're in a dilemma. If something doesn't make quite sense, life doesn't, you're not quite sure which direction to go. And then, I, as much of an effect as I could have on a patient, I've also had professors who've had the same effect on me. And, I think it's also why I keep teaching in the university, because I've had professors who have moved me as much as my own personal analysis, who see something about me, hear something in what I'm saying, can speak to some question that I have about life or whatever it is, and it can profoundly make you realize that there's other possibilities that you didn't understand to even ask about. So, but as I look around, there's very few people who take up this role for, in particular the young, who need this space opened up for them. I mean, if we're saying there's always been rules, and I agree with you, there's always been rules, there's always expectations, there's always ways in which somehow some ground can get closed down very, very easily. There's very few people who come in there and open it up. I mean, I respect both of you as philosophers, professors who do that. I mean, who else is there? Sometimes it's your family. Sometimes.
Is it always good, to have things opened up for you? Like it, Robin's, when he was originally asking you, he was gesturing at the dangers of recognizing and thereby kind of giving a bunch of oxygen to a desire that you may end up wanting to repress. And I take it that the desire to repress your desires could just come straightforwardly out of a desire to satisfy some of your other desires, right? So it can be you're a very desire-oriented person, but like one of my desires is for people to like me, and people are not going to like me if they see me expressing certain desires. And so I want to not express those desires. Now, it may be that it's easier to not express them if I don't even know that I have them. Or anyway, then I have to, like, in effect, it could even be that when you recognize that you have certain desires, you end up having to police them all the more, like end up having to shut them down in a kind of self-conscious way. So yeah, I'm just wondering about the sort of, is sort of self-knowledge and self-awareness, is that a kind of universally good thing? Is it always good? Is it to be equated with freedom? As freedom comes up a bunch of times in your essay.
Sure. I mean, I really pretty categorically want to say yes, because I think that if we start saying no, we're going to get into really big trouble. And we're going to end up taking, I mean, I could get Nietzschean about it and say we take a kind of anti-self perspective. I don't know, like turning, the best thing that we can do is turn against ourselves. I it might be the case that the desire comes out and then you want to push it down. And then, but that would all be part of the process of getting to know it to begin with, is to also have the extreme reaction to it. And I also feel like unless you're completely, even the person in psychoanalysis is probably the most concerned for people that we consider psychotic or schizophrenic, because they're the most fragile and there's something about our world which doesn't take care of them and they're falling out of it. So we're worried about them as the most extreme case. But that person is not the person who's asking a question about their desire. They're the person who's fragmented and lost and can't put themselves back together. And it actually requires a great desire on the part of us to want to make a place for them, because they will never be able to make a place for themselves. For everybody else who's not, let's say, in that extreme category, there really is for us something about needing to be in touch with your desire, as difficult as it is, and as it's not. One of the things that I think is hard is it sounds like, well, what if I want attention, or what if I want to do drugs, or what if I want to just step all over people? I don't think that that's my definition of a desire. As I was saying, there's something about the particular history that you've grown up with, the particular constraints, the way in which that is a field of wishes where you have to find yourself in relationship to it and you're having trouble doing so. And there's something obscure in that that feels like it belongs to you, that you're trying to locate yourself in relationship to, and we call that desire. It's within a very structured terrain. It's not just any willy-nilly giving into a enjoyment. So there's a definitional problem that I think I run into a little bit, which is that you say desire and people think it's like, I'm going to eat everything and I'm going to rob and I'm going to murder and I'm going to steal. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about like something at the core of a sense of self that is obscure to you about what would really bring you an impossible pleasure. I don't know. That you had.
It seems to me, and I take this to be a Freudian thought, that one of my deepest desires is not to understand myself and to for there to be things about myself that I don't see. And I have whole psychological mechanisms in place in me that exist to satisfy this really deep desire about like that, how I'm structured in relation to myself. And that's an important fact about who I am, the truth about who I am, right? And just to connect this up with sort of the framing of your piece that I found really interesting, because you say, you know, people keep coming to you wanting to be a good person and you commiserate with your colleague who's like, why don't they want to be free instead? And like, there's this question about like, so there's this desire that people are expressing to you. I want to be a good person. And you're like, in effect, I could put it so you're just saying, that's not what you really want. Let me tell you what you really want. It's to know what you really want, right? And it's like, but what if that really is what they really want, is to be a good person? So part of this is like, I almost feel like I'm on shifting sands in terms of not assuming that like all desires are desires to like just do evil, forbidden things, but just There's a lot of incoherence in what we desire. And so I'm not sure, like something else, it seems to me, needs to be guiding that process other than just figuring out what you desire.
And see, I don't find it incoherent. I think the process of getting towards a kind of coherence is very messy.
Mm-hmm.
And once you achieve it, that's never going to be the end of the story. Then you got to start all over again with like, what's next for me? But for me, it's really like in the process of psychoanalysis, it's actually shockingly coherent. And I think this is what's important. This is what's important to me. Like the desire not to know what you want for me would be like, I don't know if you had like category one, that would be like a second order desire to something underneath that is, that's not just not to know, but something that you want to get closer to, something that you would want proximity to. I mean, I would put one as a defense and one as a wish. Right.
I worry that your advice here is exactly appropriate for people in therapy and may not generalize as well to the rest of us. And so my image is that a person comes to therapy maybe because there's some concrete problem that's driving them. And that concrete problem probably has some specific structure to it. And then what you mean by desire is, what is that thing that's inside of you that's driving this whole problem? We need to figure that out. And you call that a desire, which sounds fine. But then if you aren't being driven by some concrete specific problem, I might think, I'm plastic. I could become many things. But my question is, which things to become? And in that context, you might know there's a literature on authenticity where psychologists find that people think they're the most authentic when they are doing, when they would be most socially approved of their behavior. That is, that's what they think is authentic. So in some sense, there isn't an authentic them, but one can be created. That is, you can become different things. And so in the context of a plastic person who could become different things and could explore different desires and could inflame them or suppress them, for that person, it might not be such a wise decision to say, well, just, you know, go with the desires. Let's go and find them and stop, you know, stop trying to police them or manage them, because first you need to find them. I mean, they might not exist until I find them. And maybe, as Agnes says, I'm wary of that. Maybe there's some kinds of people I could become I don't want to become.
I think this is, I mean, I'm really interested in this because I really hear this fear. I mean, I think the fear is probably there also in the patients who want to be good. And there's a fear that there's nothing there underneath at all. There's a fear that you just do this and you become a bad person. There's a fear that, you know, what's down there is in contradiction with so many other things, that what difference does it make to find it anyways? I mean, I'm so interested to hear all these fears. I mean, if I had these fears, I could not do what I do. I mean, and maybe I have a delusional conviction, but I mean, I feel like I go in with the idea that there's a process, there's a unfolding process of what it means to be an analysis. And in this process, you find, you know, I mean, it's like the literary aspects of Freud. You think, oh, this story could never have been written any other way. It doesn't amount to absolute authenticity because your desires are so shot through with your life experiences that they're hardly just your individual determined desires. I mean, they're in conversation with your parents, with your family, with the time that you grew up, with the moment that you were born, between this sibling and that sibling, or what happened at any given point in your life. It sometimes hardly even feels like your own, which is like a very hard reckoning in treatment, I think, at certain points in time. But nevertheless, I find that the greatest relief comes with the fact that there's something coherent there, that there's a field of influences, a field of factors that allows you to discover something, and that there's a little bit of freedom in there to say, okay, yeah, right, this is why I am where I am, or this is why I've suffered the way I've suffered, this is why I've made the choices I've made. You know, but then there's also a moment in which you let the person go. Then they go live their life. And what does it mean to tell that story to a public that hasn't gone through with it? What does it mean to tell that story to a public that doesn't maybe even necessarily understand that or have access to it? I mean, that's a really interesting question. I always hope it's of some value, but I just, you know, maybe I scared everyone at New York Times piece.
But I mean, my question you're addressing in some sense, the question of whether these observations and recommendations are particular to people in therapy or they're general for everybody else. So you're saying like you found enormous value in going through psychotherapy and getting to understand yourself in ways you hadn't before. And you're relying on that in your therapy with other people. And that all makes sense. But there's still the question that most people don't go to therapy. They don't want to. Are they right? Not to. Maybe the rest of us are wise not to do this.
It could be. Yeah. There's something funny, which is, I mean, psychoanalysis always has a little bit of a problem of preaching to the converted because it is speaking about a certain experience of the work. And if you haven't done the work, then, you know, we're talking about an experience that you haven't had. But then I don't know. That's the case for so many things. I mean, one of the things that I love is if you hand someone the interpretation of dreams or if you hand someone the three essays on the theory of sexuality or, God forbid, Lacan's mirror stage, normally the 20-year-old who's in a real moment in their life, these books feel like a saving grace. It gives, I mean, I've seen it over and over again in my teaching that it gives you something to hang on to in terms of something that makes sense of certain experiences in life. You know, if you read about orality, you read about anality, you read about all of the different kinds of sexualities that Freud elaborates, the students go, you know, yes, finally I understand why I've been chewing my pens, my whole, you know, whatever it is. But also it gives them a lot of feeling of freedom of the whole plethora of pleasures in a given life. So, I mean, for me, that's one reason why I think there is a way to communicate something that on the other hand is a little bit on the other side of a wall for people if they've never been in analysis. But dreams is a universal experience. Sexuality is a universal experience. The strangeness of childhood is a universal experience. So those were always the touchstones, which were designed for people to think about the organization of the field of pleasures, the field of the body, and the field of the unconscious in their own life. And I think that that has gone on for the past 120 years, not obviously for everybody, because not everyone comes in contact with it, but when they do and it means something, they you know, it's like a big aha moment.
So I basically had everything you've described. Like when I was like 25, I ran into the interpretation of dreams, became totally obsessed, spent like a year and a half of my life reading like much of Freud, a lot of other psychoanalytic theory, particularly like Beyond, who I saw you mention in one of your other essays, went into analysis myself. And everything you said was true of me, but there was the frustration that I still to this day can't quite put my finger on. It was something like that there's a kind of slide of meanings that is interminable. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I haven't read this stuff in a long time, so my memory is very fuzzy, but like, you know, there's this one essay by Freud, Analysis, Terminable and Interminable, where basically he says interminable, that these, you know, the manifest content of the dream, and then you have like a level of interpretation, but you can keep going. And it felt to me, I could be in analysis my whole life and I could continually, in effect, discover that the things where I said aha about them at one time, and now they're just symbols. And so there's this, yeah, this bottomlessness to it where the aha experience doesn't seem stable to me. Mm-hmm. That was the feeling I had about psychoanalysis.
Where's the instability, do you think? Just in the fact of the interminability, or is it in the fact of language, or is it in the fact of life going on?
It's that Let's say I could say about a, you know, you have in one of your essays that I was just reading, like you had this dream about somebody taking away your child and saying it's medical waste or something like that. I'm not remembering exactly. And it's like you can interpret that and say, oh, this is about, you know, should I continue with this pregnancy or not? Oh, sorry, you can see me, but my computer has done a weird thing that it's doing these days so that I can't see you. Okay, you're back. And it's like, say you were in analysis, right? And say you brought up this very interpretation. You can then engage in the act of actually interpreting the fact that you had interpreted it this way. And you'd be like, oh, well, the deeper meaning of my having adopted this interpretation is this, right? That and there's always room for that. There's always room for discovering that what you had taken as an insight was actually a symptom.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the interesting question of limits is interesting because obviously in relationship to the question of desire and the question that the essay brought up and also what Robin was asking about in terms of, is this a good idea at all to advocate for this? And on the one hand, I think there's the aha and the opening, but I also think there's a real painful experience of human limitations, limitations of care, limitations of pleasure, limitations of the body, limitations of what one can do, limitations like that you didn't realize existed in life because of certain illusions. So, I mean, it's interesting, even Freud's essay analysis, Terminable and Interminable, he comes on the side of interminability, but a lot of the reasons he comes up with what's interminable about it is because we're constantly for the rest of our life confronting limits, which can we often want to not experience. So I think both sides of analysis are really impossible. So there's the invitation on the one hand towards the freedom and the desire and what could be liberatory about that, but it's always within a question of limits. It's always within a field of limits. That's why I kept saying hard won, small, ephemeral in the piece over and over and over again. And, you know, Annie Ernaux saying that happiness is hard won and dearly paid for. You know, because it's not, you know, this is not like total orgasmic euphoria, which is often the image that we have of people seeking pleasure and part of the problem with an image of pleasure. There's also why I wanted to bring up the fact that we need a society that has rules in place so that we don't feel like there's just a, you know, I don't know, a feast of Babylon going on around us, because it's going to scare us and make us less likely to want to explore anything inside of ourselves, I think. I mean, I think like news headlines with like a president who does whatever is not good for us to psychically feel safe enough to even begin to look inside.
Hey, I'm going to let Robin jump in after this, but I want to ask you about a thought experiment. It's such a weird thought experiment that maybe we can't think it through, but you know, a lot of what gets discussed and analyzed in analysis are like your childhood experiences or your, you know, adolescent or whatever, the experiences you had before you went came into analysis, right? That and your dreams and all that. And it's sort of like there was, for everyone who is analyzed, there is the life they had before analysis that was untouched by analysis. What would it be if there was no such life? That is, and so I'm imagining like a baby who's already in analysis, in effect, right? Take your baby and they spend, you know, an hour a week so that as they're forming, everything about them is being formed already with this kind of sensitivity to the meaning of it. What would that do to a person? Would it be good or bad?
You know, what do I always hear? I hear like shrinks kids are the craziest. This is what people always say to me. They're like, oh boy, you know, shrinks kids are always the craziest. But, you know, again, with the question, there's something There was a piece in the New Yorker recently about the child who grew up with the father who was a Freudian, who was like somewhat revered and then somewhat mocked. And he like played this recording in the child's room of like, you and mommy are one. And he used to show her the machine that would like flash these subliminal messages. And, you know, there's something funny, which is that I also studied Jacques Lacan, you know, this whole French psychoanalysis thing. And Lacan was really not on the side of meaning and understanding, because they are limitless. And so there's something very important to him with respect to the way that desire articulates limits. Desire comes at a certain point without all of the meaning and justification. I mean, in the piece I said, you know, to a certain extent, you want to find a meaning, a justification, and at a certain place, you really actually can't find it. The desire is there. It's impossible for you for various reasons, and you jump or don't jump. And I think that that's like a pretty hard crash against a wall in terms of that kind of a limitedness, which I don't think that 1950s, 1960s analysis practiced in the United States. I think that they got into a kind of deliria around meaning and interpretation. And you saw this with the children, in fact, that they right out the gate with their own children would start interpreting. I would never give my son, I have a 19-year-old, I would never give my son an interpretation, ever. I would let him tell me something, and I would let him interpret it for himself. And if I heard something interesting, I might indicate, you know, that's pretty interesting what you're saying. But I would never, ever, on a good day, bad day, no day, do that. It's not my place, and you only do it very carefully with a patient anyway. So
it makes it really different from philosophy. That is, I've done philosophy with my kids since they could talk, and I felt at least that it was totally safe and I could do it as much as I wanted.
I would do philosophy all day long too with my son. I think there's something different because you're inviting them into thought experiments and so on and so forth. But especially me as an analyst, there's a real danger to saying, "Oh, I know, I know what you think, I know what you want."
So the initial point that we're coming in at you from the essay was this conflict between seeing your desires clearly and trying to manage them. And then we're thinking about the contrast of that for someone in therapy versus someone not. And we're bringing up children. So it occurs to me that there's a certain sense in which children often can see their desires clearly because they're not managing them, because they haven't learned how they're supposed to manage them. And that's another way to see your desires clearly, other than through therapy, perhaps. And, you know, is that a safer, simpler way to see your desires clearly? Is just to see them before you learn to see all the social rules and everything about them and what everybody else thinks about
them? It makes me think of that moment when Freud marvels at the dream. He just said, "One of my children," but I think they figured they know that it was Anna Freud. Maybe he said something to someone in a letter where she says, you know, "I want strawberries, I want apple pie, I want brownies." And he says, it's so great with the children because it's so out there, and it's already a beautiful, it's, you know, someone, I think Darian Leader pointed out that it's the kind of thing that you can't have all the time. It's not just whatever. You can't have strawberries and cakes and ice cream. It's already like the thing that's scarce. It's already slightly forbidden. It's, you know, the special, you know, icing on the cake moment. So she's already putting into sequence the objects that are starting to become forbidden and that are special. She just didn't, you know, she didn't say, "I want bread and potatoes and a meat pie." You know, it's really like the special desserts. But there's a very important moment in the way I think about the formation of desires, which is that there's a moment of repression that happens naturally around the eatable time. This is our shtick. So like around 5 or 6, something goes down, and then you get your little rule-playing children. You get your board game children. You get like, these are the rules, and this is who goes first. And now, you know, this is what has to happen on the playground. And this amazingly open child right before then goes away. If anyone's had a child, there is some transition where there's this incredible openness that gets clamped down. And this is not a bad thing. I'm with you guys. Like this moment where something is pushed down, and Freud said it comes from the social, but it also comes somehow biologically. It's also the moment that kids go to school. We naturally recognize that around that time they're able to sit down a bit more and go to proper school. Then you have a different ballgame, however, because something's been pushed down, and on the basis of what's been pushed down, a whole psychic terrain is going to develop. And I think one of the reasons that I feel safe advocating for this is because I believe in repression. I believe repression takes place. And so if I get a patient who's quote unquote out of control, I don't know, a drug addict, I have to get them out of that. And then I find the inhibited, repressed, confused person underneath it that then can do this work.
Do most people who aren't in therapy or haven't been in therapy see their desires clearly enough to function in their life? That is this extra clarity that you're going to get by therapy something that's appropriate for some unusual problems, or are most people insufficient in their clarity and would greatly benefit from being clearer about their desires?
I don't know how to talk about most people, but I mean, I think we're all pretty confused, I would say.
But we might just know we're always going to be confused. That's just the nature of being a human. And we just live with it, and we're okay with it, and we're fine. That is, we can at least, we enjoy some things, and we know which things we enjoy enough to pick them, and enough to enjoy them enough. Is that enough clarity, I guess, is the key question.
It's enough for you. It's enough for me. No, but I really mean that. Hey, look, the only, like, to a certain extent, if you get interested in this, great. If it means something to you, good. If you need to come to see me, that's a different question. But there has to be a desire there, a desire to read the psychoanalysis, a desire to start, you know, whatever happened with Agnes. Like when, you know, you read the Interpretation of Dreams, well, you had a desire to do that. So you followed it. If this doesn't speak to you, it doesn't speak to you. If you're happily living your life, great. It's not for anyone else to tell you that you don't know what you want.
There's the word freedom shows up a couple times in your op-ed, and I found this to be the most obscure point in it. What you meant by freedom, what you meant by use. There's a phrase, limits cannot be held or crossed under compulsion. They must be approached freely. And I think in another one of your essays, you talk about the fantasy of freedom, that this is about freedom of choice and pregnancy. So I just want to hear you say more about just what do you mean by freedom? What is the connection between freedom and sort of the self-knowledge of desire here? And why is this true? Or what does it mean that limits can't be held or crossed under compulsion?
You know, Lacan hated the word freedom. I wrote this one essay I wrote about working as a palliative care person during COVID. I referenced this. So I've completely contradicted myself. But he hated it, and he thought it was crazy, and he thought Americans were pretty nuts about this, because he says, you know, there's very little freedom in psychic life to a certain extent. You know, overdetermination and all of that, and just limits in general. So he didn't like it. And he also thought that there was something about this neuroticism that wants to refuse limits, mortality on the basis of this idea of freedom. So I totally understand that side of things. I think one of the worries that I had in this op-ed that I was writing that made me try to take a little bit of a different tact from that other exploration is the fact that there's something about compulsiveness at the moment. I mean, there's like for the audience to think about what they're doing compulsively versus what they feel is the place where they have a little bit of subjective freedom, a little bit of will that they add to the choices, questions, self-exploration that they do in their life. I mean, I'm really worried about compulsivity. Like, our relationship to our phones and technology is driving a kind of compulsiveness. Like, we don't even know how we're spending our time or what we're doing. We're kind of letting this take over. So that was a little bit of what I was worried about. So it was funny because I did something that I thought that I wouldn't do with putting all of this freedom business. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because from one point of view, here's one way that I might have put your point. Mm-hmm. People have a fantasy that they can choose who they are and that they can mold themselves into whatever. It's like Robin's fantasy about there's lots of different people I could be, and let me just figure out which one I should be, and then I'll make myself into that one. And that's really a fantasy of freedom, but actually there's just some facts of the matter about who you already are, independently whether you like it or not. There's who you are. There's who you really are. That's your desires. And you just don't have that much agency with respect to it. What you really can have in relation to that is kind of knowledge or transparency or awareness, but not the freedom to shape it. So that would be a story of unfreedom, in effect. But of course, you could then say, once you're aware of those things, then you can live in relation to those desires in a better way than you were living when you were living under the illusion of being able to shape yourself into whoever you wanted. And you could use the word freedom for that first thing. And that, I take it, is what you're doing.
Yeah. That's so beautiful. That was so elegantly done. Yeah. No, I think that's really important. And in a way, I mean, if there's a regret, I think it's because I think it's some way in which that needed to be more spelled out so that people didn't think that, you know, the New York Times was advocating for Lord of the Flies.
So you describe often this concept that your fear, your desires might be illicit or, you know, problematic, something you want to repress. I presume often in therapy, people discover that they do have such desires that in fact are the desires they would have wanted to repress. So what happens then? It's your legitimate, real desire, and it's one that you wanted to repress. So do you just help them repress it or ask them to maybe reconsider the rules and whether the rules should apply to them? Or, I mean, what do you do in that conflict?
You know, as an analyst, you don't do much. I mean, this is the strange moment. I mean, you let the person figure out what they want to do, and you try to listen as closely as you can. I mean, I had a long conversation with someone about whether they want to, why is it always about children right now? Whether she wants to have a second child or not. And, you know, it's funny because we had gotten to a place where she thought she had never would want to have a child, and then discovered that she did actually somewhere want to have it, and she was heavily repressing this. Second child, I don't know. She feels like she should. You shouldn't, you know, if you can, you should give your child a sibling. It's now or never. I mean, these kinds of things, but I don't know. And she's in a, you know, there's a clock and there's a lot of pressure. And I think the only thing I've said is this is really unclear.
I mean, sometimes in life, this is one of those moments where we tell people and reassure them it'll work out. Like, your mind will pick something. It'll be okay with it. You'll get on. Is that true? Is this the sort of thing that just tends to work out? You know, once you see the conflict, you make a resolution and you go past it and you're okay with it?
I mean, the nice thing is, you know, you get to be there on the other side of it. They make the choice and then you live with the aftermath of it together. And I think that's rare. I mean, the one thing Agnes was saying is, it, what would it be like if you spend your, you know, child day one in psychoanalysis? I mean, there is something very beautiful, though, about spending 10, 15 years with someone. I know this makes you look crazy. They're like, oh my God, who can afford this? This is insane. And they also don't realize that we, like, you know, chop our income in half by being analysts. I could be a one-time a week therapist and make three times the money I make, but I'm not, and I don't. But, you know, you spend a nice chunk of life with someone and you accompany them, and you accompany them with that exploration, and then they carry that with them. And I think the limit to it is very important. Like, some people think that it should, you know, there's a group of analysts that don't terminate ever. But I think the stopping is important for exactly the reasons that we were talking about throughout this podcast, that the limit, the endpoint, the non-delirious, endless meaning-making, the make a choice, move on with it, live with it, you know, don't have the illusion of freedom and authenticity, you know, you have enough experience now of bumping up against every wall. You have some experiences of revelations. You have some experiences of access to pleasures you've never thought you had. And now life goes on.
It strikes me, I know in a way it's kind of an accidental choice, but it does strike me, this choice of example, should I have kids, that we live at a time when women are querying themselves about this desire, and they want to know the deep truth about do I really want to have kids or not? And they agonize over this question. And it's something where I have some distance from it, because I never did. Like, I never thought about it. I always assumed I would have kids, and then I did have kids pretty young. And by the time we were getting to my third kid, would have been my fourth kid, the question was showing up to me. But at least the question, like, should I have kids or not? It didn't used to be a question that people asked themselves. And now it is a question that people ask themselves. And also, incidentally, fertility's gone way down, right? And there's, so like, what that's one way to, it's something Robin and I have talked a lot about. It's one way to put the question, like, is it always good with respect to a given desire for people to, for the default expectation to be that one has to engage in a lot of deep soul searching about whether or not this is one's authentic desire or not?
I mean, with the kid, you're right, because the, you know, when does birth control come on the scene? In the 1950s. So we're at what, like year 73, that this is a whole new situation. Now, the ramifications of trying to figure out whether one wants to have a child or not are really tough, because yes, and also no. No. Why not? Because your child will outlive you, so they are the marker of your demise. They are a curtailment on your freedom. They are the place that stirs up everything that you don't want stirred up about yourself. I mean, no one is going to easily say yes to this. You know, if it was an accident, or it was you were impelled to do it, then, you know, you have to live with that. But no one is going to say, okay, well, let's go back now to where women didn't have a choice. No one's going to do that, right? I mean, this has made it possible for women to do all kinds of things that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do, because they would have just been at home with kids. So we're in a really funny place. We're in a really funny place.
It's a common observation that young people, like, just make a bunch of choices, take a bunch of chances, go a bunch of places, and then they later on look back and say, I'm just amazed at how oblivious I was to all the risks. And in some sense, young people wouldn't be doing all the big things they do if they were as aware as older adults of all the things that could go wrong and all the considerations. And in some sense, that's what we're doing with children here, because you used to make those choices when you were much younger. Right. And it was just a habit, and you're oblivious to it. But there's a sense in which young people making a bunch of choices, they're oblivious to the risks, is kind of how big choices happen in the world. And I'm not so sure that was a bad thing.
No. I mean, because it happens, and then you reconcile with it rather than like doing this for years and years and years up to the face of it. And like, believe me, when I say this, when I say like it's important to explore your desires, I think if someone's hesitating, if someone is endlessly going, well, yes, but no, but yes, but no, I will work on that before I will work on the question of their desire. The fact that there's a kind of procrastination, there's a kind of, you know, whatever it is, there's a feeling of waffling or a feeling of anxiety and fear about making any decisions. You know, you'll work on that because you're not going to let someone just turn around and around and around on something. You know,
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I know you had to go at 4:15. I just didn't want to keep you past your end time.
No. If there's anything else, I can.
Well, we could go for hours. I expect so. It seems as good a break point as any, as I can tell.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. This was really interesting. It was very exciting for me to get to talk about psychoanalysis.
Oh, good.
I enjoyed it as well. My wife was a therapist for many years, so I saw it from that side of the world.
It's always hard to be the partner, I think. Yeah. But you have you have husband wife privilege, right? So your wife can come home.
Right. Although, yes. But I didn't see it from the inside. I saw it from that.
Well, thank you both so much.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Stopping.